Starting a new parsha, Parshas Matos, Rashi Matos, Yishba Mitzvah Sase Achas, Mitzvah Lo Sase Achas. There's one positive commandment and one negative commandment, Mitzvah Tavav 406, Mitzvah Din Hafaras Nedarim. The din is that when a girl or woman makes a vow, so her husband or father is entitled to nullify the vow. It's different from the procedure that we know nowadays, Hataras Nedarim, which the Sefer Chinuch will go into extensively, even though technically it's not the actual manifestation of this mitzvah. Shin stavinu b'mitzvahs Hafaras Nedarim, kelomar shenadun b'mi shenadar kasher titzaveh Hatorah. That what it means is that we're supposed to adjudicate cases based on what the Torah says when it involves a vow that a girl or woman takes. Shenemar ish ki dor neder, that a kemosh ba mivoar beparsha, that when a person vows you should the next mitzvah says you should not allow to neglect to perform the terms of the vow. And in certain situations, a woman or a girl can have her vows nullified by her husband or father. V'chasav Rambam zichron adbrachu b'sefer mitzvos b'mitzvazo v'zelashono bein ha'inyon sh'neschayev l'hafer al kol panim. What does it mean that the mitzvah is to do hafaras nedarim? Does it mean that you're required to do it? No, it doesn't mean you're required to do it. That means that if you want to do it, you should do it in the manner that is that is prescribed by the Torah. So if a woman says, comes home and she says to her husband, hey, I just took a vow that I'm not going to go shopping for a new wardrobe. So the husband's like, excellent, yes. Oh, but the Torah says there's a mitzvah to do hafaras nedarim. So I have to do hafaras. I have to be made for your nether. I'm not sure he's allowed to be made for that nether, as we'll discuss in a second. But whatever it is, there's no mitzvah to do hafaras. The husband wants the nether to stand. So he's certainly allowed to let the nether stand. The whole point is that we should do the way the Torah says that it's this case. It's a similar case if you're talking about the laws of get. So one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, as we'll get to in Parshas Kisetze, which is added this past Shabbos, and a few mitzvahs from now, many mitzvahs from now, we have the mitzvah of a get. So does that mean that there's a mitzvah to get divorced? Oh, you lose out. If you go through all of life and you don't get divorced, you only fulfilled 612 mitzvahs. Maybe that's no good. So no, that's obviously not what it means. What it means is that if you want to get divorced, so it should be done in the manner prescribed by the Torah, and that's the mitzvah. So not every mitzvah is an actual requirement. V'zeh ha'inyan ba'atzmo havein mimeni kol zman shetishmaini mona din echad me'adin. If you hear me count the mitzvah, she'ein zo mitzvah be'pu'ula me'apu'los be'achriach, it's not something that you have to do. V'ulam ha'mitzvah yoseinu mitzuvin she'nodun b'din zeh b'dover zeh. The mitzvah just means that when the situation arises, we should do it in accordance with the prescription of the mitzvah. So the Torah says that in certain situations, a husband or a father is allowed to nullify a vow. Now the Rambam mentions the more generalized sort of application of this mitzvah, which is Hataras Nedarim, that even though it does not discuss that explicitly in this parsha or anywhere in the Torah, there is a concept that we received in the tradition of the Torah Shebaal Peh that a sage can cancel the vow of any person under certain situations. It says in the pasuk that you shall not neglect to perform the terms of the vow. So yachel sounds a little bit like the word mochel, meaning to forgive. So what it means, v'darshu zecharem levracha, the hachamim have an asmacht over here, that it says, hu eino mochel aval achirem mochlin lo. When it says, lo yachel devar, means you're not allowed to cancel your vow, but others can cancel your vow under certain situations. Again, that's not an absolute drasha, that's not the actual meaning of the pasuk, but rather it's a peg that the hachamim gave to help you to connect somewhat the institution that was received in the oral tradition of Hataras Nedarim to the text of the Torah Shebiksav. So this is not an absolute proof from the biblical verse that there's such an institution as Hataras Nedarim. V'heim aleyam v'heim aleyam v'shon kvar amru heter nedarim porchim ba'avir. They say, tell you very straight up that the rules of Ataris Nadarim fly in the air. They come out of thin air, as we would say in English. There's nothing in the text of the Chumash itself that it directly indicates that there's such an institution or such a concept or such a possibility as canceling a vow. It's only the received tradition which allows such a thing. So with that, that's what we rely on. Vote.
The Rabbanim can go ahead and they can usher something which the Torah allows. They can't go the other way around.
They can, except for Sheval Tasa, so that when a situation where the Chachamim say it would be detrimental to observe a mitzvah of the Torah, so they are allowed to tell you to refrain from observing it, like what we talked about in the last mitzvah, not to blow shofar on Shabbos. But you're not allowed to say, when the Torah issues an explicit prohibition, so the Chachamim have no way to get around that, obviously, unlike what certain people nowadays would like to believe. In general, when it's not talking about Sheval Taisa, but doing it in a different manner, so then also Chazal don't have authority over that. Right. So if he were talking with something that's a neder, which is obviously a concept of deraisa, so if it weren't something that were like halacha moshvi sinai, which is on a comparable level to a deraisa, then it wouldn't work, sure. The ole mikol zeh ledateinu lefi adome. Now it's the chinuch talking. Before he was quoting the Rambam. There are two ways of canceling a vow. I'm trying to use different terminology over here. Hafara used the word nullify, and Hatara used the word cancel. You can pick different terms if you want. I'm just trying to keep them separate. So when you talk about canceling vows, there are two ways to do it. One is even one person could do a Hataras Nadarim if he is well-versed in the laws of Nadarim, which not that many people are, even rabbis, because they don't come up that much. So most people try to avoid making Nadarim, and even if they do, make something that they think is a Neder, so it's not it's often not really going to be a Neder maker Adin, so you can rely on the not so entirely real Hataras Adarim that you do at different times of year, such as on Erev Yom Kippur. Erev Rosh Hashanah, everybody does the Hataras Adarim when you go in front of the three judges, not judges, usually just three people that you happen to find after Shul. If you go to the, if you daven in the YU based Medrash on Erev Rosh Hashanah, so you might actually find three people who are well versed in the laws of Nadarim. But
you only one of them, then, right?
Correct. But you might find enough people who are well versed in the laws of Nadarim that according to some shittas, they might be a yochid mumcha. They could even do it by themselves. It was funny that you start off Hataras Nadarim, Shimuna Rabosai Dayonim Mumchim, expert judges. Mm-hmm. Huh?
The other thing is very interesting that they don't really list your Nadarim. So even if you have Dayan Mumke, but you don't tell him what the Neder is, all the Mumkes doesn't...
That's happen. Also right. That's also correct. That the problem is, they say in Hataras Nadarim, and in the text on Erev Rosh Hashanah, so I have a lot of vows, and who can remember them all, so please be matter my Nadarim. So that, technically speaking, that doesn't work. Occasionally you see Erev Rosh Hashanah, so you have people who have explicit things that might be vows that they were concerned about. So they do the Hataras Nadarim. They do. They say the actual vow. But for most people, so they just say whatever vows might be, they want to be canceled. So the poskim generally say that this doesn't work for real Nadarim. The Hataras Nadarim, Erev Rosh Hashanah, doesn't work at all. What it works for is something where it might be a shaila as to whether it would be considered to be a neder. So for example, and if you take on a chumrah or pious practice, then if you take it on and you start doing it and you have the intention to continue, So then that would be a neder. But let's say you started doing it and you really didn't have anything in mind. You just thought, oh, this might be a nice thing to do, but you really didn't have in mind to continue, or maybe you had in mind specifically not to continue. In this situation, obviously, the best thing is to say explicitly when you start doing it that you accept it, bli neder. But if you're not sure what you thought and you were going to continue, not continue, is it a neder or not a neder? So that's what we rely on. The Hataras Nedarim on Erev Rosh Hashanah, that again, but for a specific actual nether, so the Hataras Nedarim on Erev Rosh Hashanah does not work. Yeah.
So it seems almost as though the thing we go through, you know, like it's sort of like something to set your mind at ease. You think that maybe somehow or other you said something which might be a nether, you know, and you say, okay, I don't have to worry about that, at least, you know.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, it's a good analysis. To go into Rosh Hashanah with a clear conscience. That's basically what it is, yeah.
And then you also have cases where you didn't say anything, but you had in mind. You had in mind to get stuck.
So that's... No, if you don't verbalize it, that's not a nether at all. That's for
you
sure not.
Yeah.
It is without verbalizing is nothing. Part of the requirements in the Dharam, as this says, the Sefer Chinuch will mention, is piva libo shavin, that you have to have your what you take out of your mouth and what's in your heart has to be the same. You have to have a verbal and mental declaration of the nether. If you just think, so that's not.
Also make declaration on future Nedarim. If you make declaration at the.
Oh!
Nedarim,
yeah, what's going on with that?
Yes.
You make declaration that all the future Nedarim are not really Nedarim, so you kind of like.
Yeah.
So that's based on what the Gemara says, that if you want it to be that none of your vows for the upcoming year should be valid, so you should go on Erev Rosh Hashanah or on Rosh Hashanah and say, any vows that I make in the upcoming year, I hereby declare in advance, then it's that they're going to be invalid. That's what's called a moda. A moda is something that you say in front of a bezdin that affects all your actions in the upcoming year. You have this by gittin also. That is possible. We know that a get has to be given of the husband's free will. So it's possible for the husband to say, you know, because he knows that the bezdin is not going to execute the get unless he says, I'm giving the get of my own free will. So is he going to go to the bezdin and say, yes, the bezdin says, no, are you giving the get of your own free will? And say, yes. But before he goes to the bezdin, he could go to three friends and say, I'm hereby declaring before you, bezdin, I'm being moser moda, that what I say when I go to the bezdin and declare that I'm giving the get of my free will, you should know that I'm really being forced and I'm not giving it the get of my own free will. So that's
how does that work out? Yeah.
So what you do when you have a get nowadays, part of the procedure is that you nullify modos. That again, obviously, it's extremely rare this would actually happen, but just to blanket cover all situations. So the husband says, before he gives the orders for the get to be written, so he says, hereby before you, Bezdin, I nullify any modos that I may have made against the get. So then that works for that. But again, a moda, there is such a concept as a moda, something that you say in advance that could affect your actions for the future. Mm-hmm. So you can make a moda saying that any vows that I make in the upcoming year are invalid. And that works, though, interestingly enough, only if you don't remember the moda when you make the vow.
Oh.
Because if you remember the moda when you make the vow, and you make the vow anyway, that shows that your intention is in the vow is to override the moda.
Oh, I see. Right.
But there's no end to this.
But if you don't remember the moda, then your vow falls under the moda. So that's why even this moda that you make on Erev Rosh Hashanah would not work for explicit vows that you make, even when you recall that you made a moda the past year.
So in the case of the get, somebody did that, made that ahead of time in front of meeting friends or whatever, and then that means that some without the provision that at the actual based in with the get you say and everything else is canceled.
Kind of thing.
Someone could pop up then and say, but I know that's not true.
Because I heard
him make the neder, you know, 2 weeks ago that he really was being forced to do this, and this is a lie?
Yeah, you would have the Edim or the Bezdin, whatever, they would come. No, usually what would happen in such a case, if, in other words, if you had this evil scheming husband, so what you could do, usually it wouldn't be the Bezdin, usually after the fact, you know, he's really being forced into to give the get. So he gives the get to his wife that's invalid because he was forced, even though he said he was giving forced. So then, you know, a couple days later, she, you know, she's happily packing all her stuff and about to leave the house. Again, he's not allowed to be together during that time, so he was elsewhere. Right. I mean, so she's packing the house and she's leaving the house. He says, "Sorry, honey, we're back together. You know, no get. You really didn't have a get. So that's why you do to nullify the modos. Again, under normal situations, wouldn't have to be choshesh that such a thing happened, but you want to avoid any possibility of this retroactive nullification of the get. So that's why we do this, as it became part of the standard procedure of a get, to nullify any possible modos."
Oh, so that's interesting. It's one of the cases where you can nullify something retroactively. Think about conversion, but I mean, this is not the same case. But this as an idea.
No, it's just simply override. No, superseding it. Basically, it says, "I said this before. Now I'm unsaying it." You know, it's a. You know.
What do you mean? Wait, you're talking about the retraction of the moda, or you're talking about the moda nullifying the get? The moda nullifying the get? Which one?
Well, okay. I mean, the whole idea of that you are. I mean, the retroactively. Yes, I mean, but nullifying the get. But
there's not really such a thing. That the difference is that there's not really such a thing as retroactively nullifying a conversion. That what you do when we're talking about retroactively nullifying conversion, what it means is that we now have all the facts and we are paskinning that the conversion was never good to begin with.
I mean, I understand. Right. It's exactly the same. But
it's not the same mechanism.
It's sort of
yeah.
Interesting, but it's a distressing and interesting concept.
But the convert. In other words, if you discover that on the Besdin for conversion, so two of the Dayanim were brothers, which has happened before. So you discover that someone who were in rabbinical school, they taught us about such a case. Rabbi Ram, the head of the Manhattan Beis Din for Gior, comes and gives a guest lecture about procedures for conversion. So once very tragic story that he said, what they told over was that they discovered perfectly nice, you know, from a person. I think it was a woman, but it doesn't matter. But
the woman is worse.
Right, woman is worse. Kids. Yes, the woman is worse. I think it was. That was worse. So they discovered, you know, 20 years after conversion, that two of the Dayanim on the conversion Besdin were brothers. So that's absolutely possible. There's nothing. Not what to discuss. So they all had to reconvert, she and her kids, and which they did. But it's not retroactively nullifying the conversion because now we decided it's no good, or there's some mechanism we've discovered that the whole thing was invalid to begin with. But what we're normally talking about by nullifying a conversion is where everything seemed to be good, but you discover that the acceptance of mitzvos of the convert was insincere. That's what we normally talk about. So the question is, what standard do we apply to such a thing? If a woman, it's not a woman, again, we're talking about a woman, if a person converts, and
I keep everything except X.
The question is, even if the person doesn't keep it, they fundamentally accept the validity of it. So then it doesn't, probably does not invalidate the gerus. So if she says, I have to keep using female pronouns. If the person says that, you know, I completely accept that Lashon Hara is a rule of the Torah, and I know that God wants me to do that, but you know what, I'm just a gossipy person, and I'm just not going to refrain most of the time. I'll try, you know, I'll work on myself as much as I can, but there are, you know, I accept the fact that I'm probably going to say Lashon Hara. So that obviously doesn't invalidate the Geirus. She's, you know.
That's called most people's situation.
Everybody else in the world.
Right. So that, what we say about not accepting mitzvahs means that there's a mitzvah of the Torah that you fundamentally deny. Again, there's certain things that even if you might not observe that would invalidate. So if a basic mitzvah that all Orthodox Jews observe, you know, Shabbos, Kashrus, Nida, is if she says, you know, I guess I sort of accept the validity of this mitzvah, but you know what, I'm not going to do it. That means you don't really accept the validity. We're talking about mitzvahs. The only things where you have this gray area is things that most Orthodox Jews might not, you know, may need. Yeah, exactly. So
they say covering hair is one classic thing.
Oh, so
no. I mean, after all, you know, all you can say though is that at the time that she, you know, went into the mikveh, she, you know, you assume at that moment she fully believed that she was going to cover her hair when she got married. But then, like a lot of FFBs, she found out, gee, you know, this is really a pain.
So covering hair is also something. There is also a bit of gray area when it's something especially, you know, we're talking about 30, 40, 50 years ago in the modern Orthodox community, that, you know, a woman might legitimately say, you know, I studied for conversion with the Rebbetzin of my Orthodox shul. And she doesn't cover her hair. So what do you mean? You're telling me I have to cover my hair or my conversion's invalid? That's also not, that's probably not true. That if it's something that is not viewed as obligatory, even if it is, by firm Orthodox Jews, then that would probably not invalidate the conversion. Again, there's some sort of societal factor. Mm. Some conversion authorities told me that if a woman comes to a Bezdin of GPS, you know, the centralized system of the affiliated with the RCA and the, you know, endorsed by the Rabbanut in Israel, so to convert. And she says she's not planning to cover her hair when she gets married, so they will either convert her or not convert her, depending on where she's planning to live. If a woman is moving, you know, she's moving to the Upper West Side or to even Teaneck, where probably most women do cover there, but there's a significant minority that don't, or to Teaneck, then they will convert her anyway. But if she's planning on moving to Lakewood or Passaic or something like that, and she's not planning to cover her, so they will not cover her. But that, again, but even if something, like, for example, unfortunately, it's known that, 60 years ago or so, there were many young Israel-type balabatim who kept Shabbos and Kashrus, but not Nida. Yeah. Very unfortunate situation, but that's the Metzias. But I would say that since that's such an important chamor thing, that if a woman, man, or talking about his wife, if a person converts... and with the intention of not observing the laws of Nida, even if in their particular community that identifies otherwise as observant, and not planning to observe that mitzvah, then that since it's so fundamental, then a very strong argument that could be made that you should definitely not convert that person. And whether conversion is b'dievet or good or not, I'm not getting involved in, but that would be certain things are so significant that even if they're not socially done, then that would affect the validity, or at least the propriety of the conversion. Yeah.
I ask about converting children.
Yeah.
Who you ask at age 12 or 13, and they want to say yes.
Yeah.
Nowadays they're babies. And
right.
Maybe 17, 18, they say, "No, I don't want to do this."
It's a big shaila. The question is, when it says that if a person is converted as a child, then they have to if they want to undo their conversion, they have to announce when they become bar bas mitzvah that they don't want to be Jewish anymore. So the question is, does it mean that they have to do it at the time they become bar bas mitzvah, or do they have to do it the first time they hear about it after bar bas mitzvah? So in other words, if you have a someone who's 17 and his parents told him, "Oh, by the way, there's something we have to tell you." It should not be done, by the way. You should not wait till 17 to tell your child that child is adopted. But okay. But it was something to tell you. You know, you're really adopted, and we converted you as a baby, and, you know, you... and he says, "Wait a minute! I learned that converts have a choice! I never..." So it's just Shiloh, according to some opinions, since this is the first time they found out about it, so then they could protest against the conversion at this point. And the others say, once bar and bas mitzvah passes, even if they don't know about the conversion, they lost the opportunity.
And even if they do,
and how free are they?
It doesn't matter. But even if they were converted as a baby, so then when you get to bar and bas mitzvah, if on the day of bar and bas mitzvah the person says, "No, I don't want to be Jewish anymore," then that for sure that's
happened, right? In a few cases,
possibly, right? Yeah.
Which
is an awkward
situation.
How much
freedom of choice do they really have? They're living in their parents' house.
Doesn't matter.
I know, but it's not a real free choice.
Well, you know, I mean, hey, no, there are cases. I can't remember exactly where I heard of it, but you know, where a kid said, maybe he's mad at his parents, but fine, or something like that,
or he has a horrible teacher,
whatever it might be, and he said, "No, I don't want to be Jewish."
He doesn't believe in it, people. Let's think the
So. You know, and at that point, it's kind of rather awkward for, you know, the parents, because here they've got this little goy living in there in the house, and they got
it would create a very uncomfortable situation. Could be managed, but
you know, yeah. Right.
interesting.
Well, I read a story like this where the family converted, the parents converted, and the child doesn't want to be Jewish because
How old?
I think the child was, when they converted, was a baby or something like this.
Oh, but so the child did go to the mikvah.
But then afterwards he doesn't want to.
So okay, so you don't, so good, that's all right.
So, yeah. But the question I have about Nedarim is about when they do Hataras Nedarim. People mention also the wife, right? The wife makes neder, right? Here too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does the husband have this right? The wife appoints?
Yes, the husband could be a shliach to cancel his wife's nedarim, as we see on Rosh Hashanah, that some people do that if the wife can't make it to shul herself. So the rule governing that is that the husband is not allowed to gather a bezdin specifically for the purpose of nullifying his wife's vows, but if he finds three people already assembled as a bezdin, then he could add on to he could then be a shlecht and nullify his wife's vows. Basically, we're concerned. The idea behind this is that we're concerned that since the wife's vows may have a negative impact on the husband, even a situation where he can't do hafara, so then we were concerned that he would be too hasty and not gather a proper bezdin, and or maybe not not have the proper explanation for why he would want to nullify his wife's vows. So you have to find three people who are already assembled. There's one more comment that we'll go on about the conversions, is just to clarify the point about retroactively, what you call retroactively nullifying. So you have gray area when it comes to the time lag between the conversion and when the evidence surfaces that the convert might not actually have had full intention of accepting the mitzvos. So if what we're talking about, when we, you know, what was in the news about nullifying conversions, is you find out 6 months, a year later, that the person is not living a fully firm life. So does that,
it was 20 years later, right? It's more recently.
Yeah. That's, technically speaking, you know, if a person sincerely converts and then, you know, a few days later says, whoops, you know, I made a mistake. Technically speaking, the conversion is absolutely valid. Once an absolutely valid conversion happens, so that's it. You know, once then they'll go off the derech and they'll just be considered a Jew off the derech as opposed to a not goy. So the issue is, if you have something that makes it so obvious, such as, you know, you come right out of the mikvah and you go celebrate at McDonald's. So since it's so obvious in such a situation that the conversion was never, again, theoretically, it's possible that the person was completely sincere when dunking in the mikvah and the conversion was absolutely valid, and then when they got dressed, they said, hey, you know, whoops, I'm too intimidated by this, I'm going to McDonald's. Whoa. But in such a situation, I think we would be justified to say that there's an assumption or a chazaka that if the person went straight to McDonald's, that the sincerity of the conversion was never real. So therefore, we would paskin in such a situation that the person is not Jewish. Yeah.
Well, wouldn't we be doing this, you know, where it was a favor by a nullifying conversion? Because that, you know, he'd say, okay, oh, guess what? You're not a Jew who's going to be high of kares now because of what you're doing. You know what you're doing. Now you're just somebody who's a regular goy. You can eat at McDonald's or do whatever.
Okay, we don't go by favors. We go by what's the din. But in this situation, we would
have... You know, right?
Right, but if a person lived a frum life for... So what about a few days? What about a few months? But if a person lived a completely frum life for 10 years... And then all of a sudden was discovered not to be living a firm life. So that's, I don't believe there.
Appeared to be living a firm life.
Yeah, I mean, have you, I don't know what's going on in anyone's head. You have to go by.
To have been living a not firm life for how long in this period?
No, I'm saying you lived it was considered, nobody knew anything was amiss for 10 years. Maybe there was nothing amiss.
Right. And then all of a sudden you see them eating a Red Lobster, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, so in such a situation, there's not really a justification.
Well, maybe they're having a bad day. I'm thinking in this particular case.
Yeah.
I must remember this. This was a couple of years ago with some woman, and it was 10 years before. So you remember this?
Yeah, yeah, vaguely.
What was the story?
Uh-huh. But no, this was.
I can't quite remember the alphabet.
This was an Israeli.
Oh, there is a very. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
And I think that it was widely suspected there was something sort of political about it, or you know, there was like a, you know, there was a.
So there is a somewhat extreme shita that says as follows. You have a bezdin that was doing conversions And many of their converts, a few days or years or who knows how long later, were discovered not to be living frum lives. So what does that mean? It means that Beis Din was not sufficiently investigative, didn't do their due diligence to determine that these people were really intending to live frum lives. So if so, the psul is not on the conversion per se, but on the Beis Din, the conversion is no good because the Beis Din was pasul.
I'm lucky, you know.
And that was the case, right?
Right, that was something that happens also. So that, to argue that a conversion is not good b'di'eved when the convert is sincere, because sometimes, again, if it's one in a 100 conversions, so obviously this wouldn't affect the Beis Din according to any shita, but if it's a high percentage of conversions that really indicated that they weren't doing their due diligence, to argue that the conversions that are sincere are not good even b'di'eved because the Beis Din is pasul, is very, very difficult to argue. Yeah.
But, you know, in the case, for example, you said about the brothers.
The two brothers.
That the, you know, that the Gerim may have been completely from, you know, the whole time that they were, you know, but it doesn't make any difference because the Beis Din was
that's possible. True, but I'm saying in this, if one of the Dayanim at the Beis Din was discovered to be reform, I mean, so that also doesn't valid. But I'm saying in this situation where the Dayanim thought they're doing a good job, they're from Orthodox people themselves. And they just happened to not to do their due diligence, or they even if they held, maybe they held b'shita of a lower standard of Kabbalah's mitzvahs. Even if they made a mistake regarding that prat, the ones that they did that were good to argue with them, because the Beis Din is absolutely invalid, is a difficult, very difficult shita.
Well, question, yeah. I mean, you said this really happened, the two brothers on the Beis Din.
Yeah.
If they were smart enough to be on the Beis Din and convert, how did they not know that?
Did everyone who was doing conversions, you know, in the past 20, 30, 50, 40, 50 years was...
I think there was a Beis Din which had...
There is a shita based on the Gemara in Yevamos that says that if a person immerses in the mikveh with the intention of being Jewish, then even if the conversion itself was not witnessed by a Beis Din, then the conversion is valid b'di'evit. It's like some sort of de facto gerus. So we don't normally rely on this opinion by itself, but when there are other mitigating factors, it's another reason for leniency. So if there was some issue potentially with the Beis Din, but let's say, you know, it's a married woman who presumably after conversion immersed in the mikvah many times, and she thought she was Jewish and she was doing it for the sake of a mitzvah, so that is an additional grounds for leniency in certain types of situations. Or man is more of a problem, because some men never go to the mikvah, some are only Erev Yom Kippur, and men's mikvahs are not necessarily kosher for gerus anyway. So, anyway, for a woman, again, as you pointed out, it's much more important because it affects the status of the children, which is not the case of a man. There was also a case, there are in the horror stories, there was a case that we learned about in Shiran Mikvos, that... there was a certain community with a mikveh that we know that one of the ways, usually you have, in most modern mikvahs, you have many fail-safes, backup systems that the mikveh should remain kosher even if something goes wrong. But here, they were using, there was a certain community that had a mikveh that had only one system of connecting the pool where you actually immerse to the kosher rainwater, which is that they relied on the idea that if you have like a tube, a wide tube that connects the pool of water that you're going to change frequently to clean with the stagnant pool of rainwater, which is the kosher water for immersion, so that that's good enough. You don't need the other systems. So the problem was that they discovered that the hole in the... Again, crazy situation. They discovered that the hole in the... the bore where they were keeping the rainwater was misaligned with the side of the place where you were actually immersing.
Totally misaligned, so no water was getting through.
Yeah,
Totally?
Yeah, or it was above the water line or something where the waters were not connecting. So, okay, so if you're talking about the women who immersed for Nida in this mikvah, so it's bad, it's terrible, obviously, but okay, so you you repent on Yom Kippur, and you know it was a, it was the onus, you know, it was a sin that was done without any really culpability on the part of the individual who's doing it, because they did what they were supposed to do. They thought their mikvah was under the supervision of a competent authority, and it wasn't. So that's less of a problem, even though it's a bigger sin, you know, sir, karis potentially, although maybe the mikvah is kosher midrash anyway, but whatever it is. But the bigger issue was the converts. That doesn't help. The all the al-chaitz on Yom Kippur doesn't help that. So what are they going to do with all the converts? So they called, I think they said Rav Nissen Karelitz, is a major posik in Bnei Brak. So after working on it very very hard, he decided that in this such a type of emergency situation that the mikvah might potentially have been kosher according to some opinions because of the way they fill the actual immersion pool with the tap water. So therefore, he said that we should not invalidate the conversions of all the people. In addition to the fact that if it's a woman especially, so if she's having children, obviously, so she's going to be going to, hopefully not that one, but occasionally maybe a different mikvah. And in addition to that, so that might be a way to affirm the validity of these conversions.
Where was the mikvah located?
I don't know, and even if I did, I wouldn't tell. I don't think it would be a good idea to tell you. But it was not, this information was not imparted to us. It has been fixed, apparently.
And it wasn't in this neighborhood.
It was many years. It was like 20. It was like 20, 30 years. It was really bad. I believe it was. If anybody's nervous because it's close to their current domicile, from the best I could glean is that the mikveh was out of town. It's not in the New York area. Okay. So that. But I don't know where. I don't know where it was, and probably better if none of us find out about it. Okay.
Anyways, all the time.
Whole town full of Bnei Nida. That's great. Yeah.
Huh? Yeah. Except again, it's possible if Midaraisa, especially, it's very likely that the it's almost certain that the mikveh was at least kosher Midaraisa.
So that's
the question is that they got Rav Nissen Karelitz that in an emergency situation rely on certain shittas that might be kosher even derabanan based on a combination of different factors, which I'm not going to go into in detail right now. But if you want, we'll yeah. It goes against the klal of the Chazon Ish, right? Everybody knows the quip of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish once apparently quipped that he never saw a pasul a mikvah or a kosher eruv. That's what his. Apparently the Chazon Ish said that. Anyway.
Isn't it true, though, that the sophistication about building mikvahs has increased? That there, it's possible that. Maybe 100 years ago or something, there would have been a lot that by today's standards wouldn't quite.
There are definitely more chumras in mikvahs that are built nowadays than there were 100 years ago in terms of institutional chumras. But on the other hand, hygienic standards were lower 100 years ago, especially talking about in Europe. So all the problems with mikvos are caused by the fact that people want to change the water frequently. The most kosher mikvah would be you build a watertight thing in the ground. You let rain fill it up.
Yeah.
You never change the water. You just immerse in that water. That would be 100% kosher mikvah l'choladeus. The whole problem is we're trying to find kunsen to try to be able to change the water without filling it.
Yeah.
Right. So that's so there are more in those systems of changing the water. There are more chumras nowadays, but. In terms of Meikar Adin, if mikveh is built properly, even 100 years ago, it shouldn't have had a problem.
In this case, couldn't they have just taken the converts to the river? And when they saw there was a problem, they could have just re-immersed?
Well, maybe they didn't have records of everyone who immersed in this particular mikveh. Maybe the converts, it's to track everyone down and make them re-immerse in a kosher mikveh.
Well, and if they have children... Then...
And if
I'm saying in terms of the river, just to make sure.
You could, I guess. In this situation, they felt that wouldn't be practical. And again, if you also creates problems that if you have children and grandchildren that you can't that you don't necessarily keep track of, then you have big issues.
Can of
worms. Okay, so fine. So the Hataras Nedarim. Oh, so the Hataras Nedarim that we do in Erev Rosh Hashanah is also is one thing, and then we also have another neder related thing on the Yomim Noraim, which is Kol Nidre, which is a much older minhag, obviously, than the Hataras Nedarim of Erev Rosh Hashanah. So originally, Kol Nidre was a ceremony of Hataras Nedarim that was in the past tense. That was every nether that we vowed from last Yom Kippur to this Yom Kippur should be nullified. So famously, Rabbeinu Tam says, how does that work? There's no Bezdin here. There's no Charata. You know, people are not asking for a reason to, for their nether to be canceled. So how could that be? It must be that what Kol Nidre was really supposed to be is a declaration on the future, like saying that all the nedarim that you make in the upcoming year are going to be nullified, like a moda. So that's why it became very strange, because the text of the Kol Nidre was changed. Instead of from last Yom Kippur to this Yom Kippur, it was changed to read from this Yom Kippur to next Yom Kippur. But the really weird part is they didn't change the tense of the verbs. The verbs are still in past tense, but the declaration is in future tense. That shows you that the original was really totally in the past, but then based on Rabbeinu Tam, they just didn't change the past words. So the Kol Nidre says, what does it say? Din darno dishtabano dacharimna, that the nedarim that we vowed and made oaths and made charamim from this Yom Kippur to next. It's odd. So that's why in certain people have even changed the text of Kol Nidre to reflect the verbs. Yeah,
but how is Kol could possibly be effective for anybody other than the Chazan? Nobody else is saying it.
People do say it quietly along with the Chazan.
Oh, okay, all right.
No, yeah, no. And some shuls like the YU based Medrash, they do both. They say both in Kol Nidre from last Yom Kippur to this Yom Kippur and from this Yom Kippur to next Yom Kippur. Okay.
But what is the meaning of from this Yom Kippur to next Yom Kippur?
What do you mean?
I mean, what is the point of saying that?
It's a year. You just give an arbitrary. The next time you say Kol Nidre.
What is the point of saying I annul any vows I make in the future? So if you say if this creep with the get then said that,
that's not a nether. That wouldn't apply to this. Mm-hmm. It's a moda. It's a different thing.
What?
That's a moda. It's not a nether. A nether in terms of that. If you say anything I say in the upcoming year will be canceled, it wouldn't apply to a get. It has nothing to do with a get.
But this wise guy...
The wise guy's not vowing anything. He's not vowing anything. He's simply saying...
No, but he's decided to give the get, and then...
What kind of vow is it? It's not usually saying, what I'm going to say is insincere, but I really mean is this. But that's not a vow. I vow not to do, not to get benefit from potatoes or something.
I mean, you could vow, or take an oath, rather, take a shavua, to eat either to give a get or not to give a get. That's also something you could do. So according to some shittas, not everybody agrees with this, but according to some opinions, if a man takes an oath to give a get, so that get is considered to be forced and it's invalid.
He forced himself.
Because he forced himself, basically. But I think the majority shittas, again, we're choshish for the minor, lots of things by gittin, but I think the majority shittas is that's not called forced, you did it yourself.
Yeah.
It was totally of your own volition, so I'm not going for it. But nevertheless, in addition to canceling the modos, in a modern get ceremony, part of the procedure is that you do a Hataras Nedarim, just to cover all bases, to make sure he's not being forced even by his own vow or oath. So Kol Nidre, so Professor Steiner, as a recently retired professor at the Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies, at YU, one of the greatest experts in the world on Semitic languages, or a firm individual, he created a text of Kol Nidre where he tried to change it. Instead of to past tense, he just changed it to present tense, so which can apply to the future, but so it sounded more similar. If you change them all to mamish future tense, so people will be totally taken aback. They're saying something else in Kol Nidre. No, it's a
Aramaic grammarians are there in a typical shul. I don't know.
Name two.
He's okay. He's if anybody's gonna deal with it, it should be him. He's really tops. Big Mikadesh Shem Shemayim. A lot of his work is linguistically trying to undermine. Again, his work is not what you call frum apologetics. He's a very, very serious academic scholar. A lot of the work he does is linguistically trying to undermine people who say, "Oh, this part of Tanakh, you know, was really written at a much later time, so it couldn't have been written at the time you say." So linguistically, he tries to prove a lot of times that that it's really not true, that it could have been, that it's easily attributable to the time period that we traditionally believe. So the
what's his name again?
Steiner, Richard Steiner. So, fine. So, those are the two vow nullification ceremonies that we do towards the beginning of the year. As Reb Charlie said very nicely, that it's more than to actually cancel our vows, but it's to put our minds at ease, so we shouldn't be all nervous that we have vows hanging over our heads as we enter the new year.
But I still don't get it. What is the point of saying all the things I vow in the next year are invalid? What's the point of making the vows? Or is that...
Because again, like I said, it only applies if you don't remember this declaration when you make the vow.
What?
Why would you make a vow?
Well, no, why would you say in advance...
Oh, because you're nervous about not fulfilling your vow, but then in the heat of the moment...
Here we go. Somebody or other, you know, here we go. Okay, you say it called Nibir. Then later on, you know, it somehow or other, there's an auction for similar, and somebody says, "I pledge $10,000. And he's got, it doesn't say Blee Netter. Then at that point, then he can remember, you see?
We're talking about in the heat of the moment. You realize that you might be prone to making vows in the heat of the moment that you really don't want to fundamentally in your calm state of mind. You say this thing. But if you remember it, then you have a problem.
Actually, does that qualify as a netter?
Maybe not. We'll get to that. We'll get to that probably next time. But possibly something that's totally exaggerated does not actually count as a netter.
But you said you have to say it out loud.
Yeah.
Not just being intentional.
Uh-huh.
So just having to say it out loud makes it it's a little bit of a safeguard.
Right. We have, I've heard also that therapists, one symptom of OCD that sometimes manifests itself in the Orthodox population is when you have people who believe that every commitment that they make in their heads, they think of as a netter.
Oh.
And they get totally distraught when they all these thoughts pop into their heads. You know, I commit to do this and this and this and this and this and this. And they really don't want to do that. Or even if they really want to do it, they can't. They don't eventually do it. So they get very distraught that they didn't fulfill their nedarim.
How loud do
you have to do? In Yonah Diyoma, we have Rabbi Schwartz. We gave an example of, again, we generally discourage vows, but sometimes one of the things that classically in Chazal is considered to be a good usage of a vow is to encourage yourself to be more righteous, you know, to fulfill halachos better. So Rabbi Schwartz, in his article that he published a few weeks ago about his experiences being a rabbi in a Orthodox community that's mostly singles, he discusses his experiences with his congregants who, being older and single, would sometimes be in compromising situations, and they would feel guilty about going farther than they intended with intimacy. So they would take, he dealt with a few people who took a nether, that I'm only going to go this far and no more, with my girlfriend, whatever. So they didn't adhere to that. So then they felt very guilty.
On top of it, they felt more guilty.
So you end up, in addition to whatever Avera they were doing to begin with, so you have, in addition to that, that you were lo yachal dvaro, that you're not fulfilling your nether. So again, in general, it's not a good idea. Basically.
Yeah, it'd be very awkward for somebody to go in front of a beis din and say, "I want to have a toast and darim for saying that I'm going to limit my intimacy with my girlfriend." I mean, that's please let me,
off.
Yeah, right. Let me do everything without a clear conscience. That's sure. No, that doesn't seem to be.
Yeah. You don't have to tell.
You do. You do. When, if you have an actual nether,
a real Hadar's
Dharma of a specific nether, you do. You do actually have to tell. So again, so it's not a good idea unless there. Again, this is something where, in the heat of the moment, again, you shouldn't put yourself in compromising situations. But in the heat of the moment, it's likely that you're not going to fulfill your nether. But there might be certain things where you wouldn't do it if you didn't have a nether, and you would do it if you do have a nether. So in such a situation, nether is appropriate. But again, we generally discourage taking taking the dharm. But okay, so we'll continue next time. Blue nether. Ha ha ha.
I keep meaning to tell you.